Introduce yourself, please.
Hello, I'm State Representative James Todd from District 29 in Kansas.
Good to have you here. We're going to get to the podcast. First, the open. This is Statehouse Blend. I'm Sam Zeff.
And I'm Brian Ellison. We're using coffee
and donuts
to better understand the legislatures on both sides of the state line,
the issues and the people in Topeka
and Jeff City. Here we go.
And joining James and myself this morning in the KCUR 89.3 production studio, Lisa Vagelin from Prairie Village, also a member of the Mainstream Coalition, and we'll talk about that. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And the man who puts the hashtag in front of Candace Ledge, my colleague Brian.
You should
put that on your
cards.
Yeah. My colleague Brian Lowry from the Wichita Eagle. Thanks for coming over.
Thank you for having me, Sam.
We're going to talk school funding, judges, and because this is Kansas, we're also going to talk anybody?
Budget.
Guns.
Guns. Guns and budget.
But we start with my two favorite questions. James, tell me about your family and your pets and how in the world you got to the Kansas State House.
My family, I guess I could start there. I don't have any pets, so I can skip that topic. Other than my girlfriend, she has a papillon that's a little, I don't know, ball of fun.
Well, we can count that as a pet.
Well,
are we going to count that as a pet?
Yeah,
all right,
yeah,
all right. Sure. We're all agreeing on that. Okay.
What's its
name, by the way?
Angel.
Angel.
Yeah, of course.
All right. So you grew up.
I grew up in Kansas City area, kind of all over. My dad is from the Kansas City, Kansas, so I went to Turner Schools for a while. My mom graduated from Shiner Mission Northwest, and that's where a lot of my family is there. My parents were divorced. My mom actually passed away last year. She had multiple sclerosis. I have two sisters. One is 3 years older than me. One is 3 years younger than me. One of them lives in Alabama, where I grew up. Also, was a little while as a child. So, as of yet, not married. So, I do have a girlfriend.
And how'd you find your way into politics?
I guess opportunity presented itself. Everybody here would be fully aware of the 2012 and the court redrawing of boundaries and everything that occurred. I had previously been involved in some campaigns and had always maybe held out the idea that eventually I could get involved in politics. And 2012 happened. There was all this craziness, the Monday morning, people showing up at the state house, reps drawn out and drawn into with other reps to having to run against each other. And the district that I represent, the 29th, because the rep that would have been there, which Jim Denning, was running for the Senate. It was an open seat. And so I threw my hat into the ring and was lucky enough to have won.
And you're in your second term, right?
Yes, I am.
All right. Well, in that case, then we will take our first trip around the table. And I will ask you, Lisa, what is on your mind for Representative Todd this morning?
Well, the Supreme Court funding case is a big one. I am a parent of two children in the Shawnee Mission school system, and I'm also a graduate of Shawnee Mission East myself. I have been very concerned, especially even over the last few weeks, of what feels to me like a very anti-public education or sort of hostile environment legislatively around public education. There were Brownback taking money out of CAPERS. There's a bill to expand tax credits for private schools. There was stripping of gifted education, although that didn't pass. And so all week I've been thinking about those issues. Now with the Supreme Court ruling, how is that how is the legislature going to respond to that ruling in general to make sure schools don't close by June 30th, but also particularly in an environment that feels very hostile towards education and, frankly, towards the Supreme Court justices who made that decision?
So two questions there. First, let me just first clarify. I don't think the governor is taking money away from CAPERS. He's delaying a payment.
Yes, thank you.
Still, that is a lot of public employees up in arms.
And it's not definitely going to happen yet. It's just
it's a proposal that's out there.
It's something that's allowed within the budget,
and it has
to be done. CAPERS would be held whole. None of the money. It can't be reduced. Because in the budget that we pass in the House, obviously – the budget is still going to have to go to conference committee and we'll get a cumulative
budget. And the Senate dropped that proposal Thursday night. The Senate had a similar proposal in its bill and just scrapped it. They said too many people are upset about this. We'll just get rid of it. So,
but it's still
it might be worked out in negotiations.
Right, it is still hanging out there, and it will. And we the budget will obviously go to conference committee. Yeah. But let's go back to the question: what is the Kansas legislature going to do to bring equity, which is the part that the Supreme Court ruled on this past week, into compliance so that public education continues beyond June 30th?
Well,
bizarre question.
Well, no, it's a fair question. I think the difficulty that I have right now, I can't speak for the legislature at large. There's 125 members and everybody has different opinions on how they want to do things. And I certainly can express some consolidation with you in that there's been a number of things I've introduced in the health committee that I'm – or not health, education committee that I'm not necessarily a part of. And I think a lot of those, some of them have been withdrawn. I don't think a lot of them are going to see the light of day. Anybody can introduce different bills and they can get hearings. But on the equity portion, the confusing thing for me – and I actually have a copy of the case here. I've read through it a couple of times. The Supreme Court in the last ruling gave and they expressly discuss it in the court case that they just came down with. They gave the legislature two options. Number one, they could – we could fund equity under the old formula for determining equity as far as it applied to capital outlay and as it applied to local option budget. Or the legislature could make a modification to how they formulate that equity portion of education formula. The legislature, in essence, took the latter. And we made a modification to how we formulated equity and how that money would be divvied up. Now the Supreme Court has ruled that that modification is inequitable, unconstitutional. I don't know that there's a great amount of guidance on what would then be constitutional other than just funding under the previous formula. And so I think right now anybody who's working on a formula, which to me is one of the number one goals coming into this session, we can't continue with the block grant formula. That's a stopgap for us to work on a new funding formula for education that takes into account all the different factors that need to be done. But for reapplying a new or a different type of equity, I don't know that there's any certainty that the Supreme Court would rule that one equitable either unless we just went back to the other one. It's kind of – to me, it's kind of confusing as far as legal reasoning because they say – that we can make the modification, but when we make the modification, then they ruled it unconstitutional. And there's not a tremendous amount of guidance on what would be the type of modification that they would rule to be constitutional.
I want to bring Brian in on this in just a second, but let me just say that if there was too much guidance, don't you think that there would be the claim that not only that you're legislating from the bench, but you're like micromanaging super duper legislating from the bench? I mean, would that not be the charge?
I agree with you on that, and I think that that's what the court in essence is trying to avoid. I don't have any qualms with the court. I think that they are acting within their province. I think you're absolutely right. So if they provide too much, people are going to get upset. Well, when you don't provide too much, and then the legislator acts within its province, and mm-hmm. a lot of people throw out the accusations or complaints that, you know, this is legislative prerogative. We are the people who make these decisions, and there should be more deference to what we do. But the Supreme Court's been ruling, not just this court, but courts for the last 20 years, right. School finance formula is unconstitutional for, I think, since 1993. And so it's kind of difficult for a legislator to know what you can do that's going to be ruled constitutional at this point.
Right. Brian, I was over here when the ruling came down. You were in the State House. Mm-hmm. So I want to get a sense of what it was like over there, because yeah. everybody knew the opinion right. was coming down. The Supreme Court had announced it the day before.
Well, and the day that it came out, it's really important to emphasize, and this is one reason it was I worked a 13-hour day that day because
they pay
House,
overtime down there.
the House was having a budget vote,
right,
and then the Senate was going to have a mm-hmm. Budget debate and vote later that evening, and so there were several lawmakers, including the House Speaker, who were a little bit perturbed that the court, which normally releases opinions on Fridays, just so happened to choose that specific Thursday to release the opinion. The House Speaker called it "quote unquote" fishy. Now, so there were a mix of different reactions on how to do that. There were some lawmakers who were saying, "Why are we going to vote on these budgets now? These budgets have become irrelevant, basically, because they don't address the school funding needs. So that the budgets, they leave about – I think the House budget leaves about $5.9 million in the bank at the end of this fiscal year. The Senate budget leaves about $6.7 million. The senators seem to be under a false belief that there's left $32 billion, but it's actually just $6.7 million.
I just want to say I saw Brian doing the math on Twitter.
And so
very, very
The House
helpful.
Members, I will say, you know, they did actually know what their budget left when they voted on it. I don't think the Senate did.
Well, we have a good committee chairman who keeps us up to date on
But there were some lawmakers who, and there was an attempt to do this in both chambers, who wanted to send the budgets back to committee for more work in the face of the ruling. There were other lawmakers, including your appropriations chair, Ron Reichman, who said, no, this is our starting point. This makes sure that the rest of state government is funded for the rest of the year. We've got till June 30th to address this court ruling. Get this done. This then allows us to focus on school finance. So I guess one question for you, Representative, is just if you could kind of talk about the rationale of voting on a budget, which, I mean, is going to have an asterisk next to it, both because it doesn't address the school finance needs and also because of a couple other things. I mean, there's some money that we're counting in there from step therapy, from privatizing the Bioscience Authority. That still relies on legislation that hasn't been signed into law yet. So There's some lawmakers who are saying, well, this isn't actually a balanced budget yet. I mean, do you think it's worth getting this budget passed, getting it signed into law, even though you're going to have to come back and do more work on it later for sure?
I think so. I mean, in my 4 years, we've dealt with some of the other matters separately. We've dealt with education on separate bills as far as, I mean, in the 2014, after the last court case, we had a separate education bill that dealt specifically with how we were going to address the equity. I don't think it's irrational for us to continue on that kind of a approach this time. And again, just looking back at the court case itself, it does not require us to spend more money. And so there is not necessarily budgetary action if it would be the province of the legislature to come up with a new formulation on how to distribute whatever supplemental aid that is done in an equitable way. Now, again, the guidance and all that goes back to my previous point as far as what we should do. I think everything else, kind of on the back end of all of this, and I think everybody in the House at least knows because our appropriations chair, Ron Reichman, has been a big advocate of it. He got it in last year's budget, is that the other focus that we want to have is being able to go through the efficiency study recommendations. Yeah. And I can't remember what the number is. I think it's $2 billion over a couple of years.
Five years.
I don't think anybody expects it to be that much money, but there might be a couple of things in there that are worthwhile for us to look at. And I think that ultimately is going to affect what the ending balance of this budget is, what it's going to be for 16-17. And getting this budget moved on, even if we don't vote on it in the next week, I don't know what that's kind of above my pay grade on when we'll actually vote on the conference budget. But getting it out of the House, getting into conference, then allowing our budget subcommittees go through these recommendations and figure out if there's anything that works for Kansas. I really do think there's going to be some of those things. I don't know what the dollar amount is. I don't know what the dollar amount will be for this. That's why they're outside recommendations, and let's see if any of it works for Kansas.
I want to have Lisa talk about the mainstream coalition in a second, but I just want to follow up on that real quick and ask you, in a session where leadership desperately wants to get out before 90 days, certainly doesn't want to go to 113, 114. Mm-hmm. I don't know what we bid it up to last year. I forgot. Are you going to be able to get all this budget work done, work on equity, and have time to really do a deep dive and implement some of these cost savings that was in the consultant's report? That seems like an awful lot of work.
Well, I don't know if we'll get out early. I think there was a desire to try and get out really early. I've heard speculations. I'm not speaking for leadership, you know, 75 days, 80 days, different things like that. Depending upon what your expectations were coming into this session, my expectations coming in was that we would vote on a school finance formula. We had interim committees that were looking at it. We have an education committee that's already looking at it. We have I think we've had bills and education budgets that have been introduced. That is already being worked on. And so if that – we vote on a new new school finance formula, it's going to have an equity portion of it. So to me, that timeline personally hasn't changed. And I – again, who knows, because you have so many different people, and I'm, again, not speaking for leadership and what their expectations are. So for me, that's already done. And I – again, we – the budget – this is really early. This is the earliest I've ever been in the legislature, and we passed a budget. Oddly enough, it's the most people I've ever seen vote on the budget as well. I think in my 4 years, we've never had more than 63, and we had 68, because it does do a lot of other good things as far as putting money in, into the corrections department to try and bump up officers' salaries.
Well,
and
I just saw an article, was it just this morning, by Weigel saying she – I mean, she's on the record saying she doesn't see how the equity issue is going to get solved in this particular session. Like, she's already – I mean,
she had said before session that she wanted – the full 2 years of the block grant to craft the new formula, but I mean, you guys have the June 30th,
right? But you could do both, right? I mean, you don't have to. You don't. I mean, the Supreme Court was clear that you can solve equity any way you want as long as they're pleased with it. And if that means that you're going to put more money into the block grant for now, it seems to me that I think the Supreme Court would go with that.
To the representative's point, he's right. You know, this is my third session. I've never seen one move this quickly. It's been very intense. You almost get the sense of they're so concerned about having another long session that they want to pack it all in to – I mean, you guys voted on the budget on the 31st day. And so things are moving very quickly. I think some people like that because it means important work is getting done quickly. But I think there are also some people who want to kind of slow things down to make sure, you know, everything is getting truly vetted. But it is – it's been an intense session so far, because whereas last session was a marathon, this has been a sprint so far.
I mean, I would say as a constituent and as a parent, I mean, our school system is starting a required financial literacy course in the high school session now. And and I just have to say, you know, to pass a budget knowing, like you said, that there are these asterisks attached to it, doesn't, you know, writing checks on money that you know that you have to spend more doesn't seem to me to be responsible. So that, you know.
Well, I guess last year we passed – well, the Senate passed a budget before we had a tax plan in place, and the budget was sitting there. And that budget, if you want to make a corollary to this one, would have been unpaid but for action on taxes or some kind of revenue sources. So just because you have a budget sitting there, it's not passed – finally by the House. It's not signed by the governor. Nothing's been done. It's moved down the process. And I think getting this in the conference committee is reasonable at this point in time.
I just want to take a second here. Usually, sitting in Lisa's seat is just a regular old citizen. But Lisa is both is both a citizen and a member of the mainstream coalition. I just want to take I want you to take a minute or so, not too terribly long.
Sure.
Tell me a little bit about the mainstream coalition and when it formed. And as you do that, I'm going to ask James to pour me a little bit more coffee, if you wouldn't mind.
And I'm also old. Thank you. Mainstream Coalition was founded a little over 20 years ago by Dr. Bob Menneely and other leaders in the community. Mainstream is an advocacy organization for moderate politics. So we focus on educating the public about legislative issues. We advocate for moderate policies. And through our PAC, we work to elect candidates who support those policies and values.
Where does Representative Todd fall on the moderate coalition scale?
I might like to ask him.
Well, then, you know what? We will count that as a question.
Well, you know, getting involved in state politics has maybe been very eye-opening to me on where I do fall. I am, and I'm familiar with Mainstream Coalition, and I'm aware of some of their positions. I'm a pro-life individual. I know that's something that they advocate for. As far as on the opposite of being pro-choice, you know, when I talk to my Democrat friends and we discuss national politics and some of the issues that go on, they see me as rather conservative. And then when we talk about things that are involved in Topeka and maybe where I differentiate with some other people, I oftentimes get called a moderate or an establishment. I feel like I'm kind of one of those tweeners, if I were going to say anything. I don't think that I fall hard on the right, but I'm certainly not, I guess you would say, in coalition with moderates or anything like that. I just try and bring as reasonable and open-minded approach as I can.
Reasonable? You can't. You can't argue with that.
Reasonable sounds good to us.
All right, let's move on to. I want to move on to judges now. There is it failed in the House. It didn't get 2/3, but there is a movement to change the way we pick Supreme Court justices in Kansas. There was also a bill filed in the Senate that would expand impeachable offenses for Supreme Court judges. That happened after the Gannon case. James, I want to know where you are on how we pick justices for the Kansas Supreme Court.
Well, I carried the bill in the House on the floor as far as changing the way that we picked our justices. I am an advocate for moving to the federal model of judicial selection. I would say my position on why I support it is largely because I think that we have a very good independent court at our federal level, and I think the people of Kansas would be very well served on that. Wasn't aware of the bill in the Senate that she has talked about as far as expanding impeachment. For me, it gets frustrating to talk with some people who want to attack the court, like we had the Gannon decision come down. I think that's the court operating within their province. I think that if you change the way that we nominate justices, it's not going to change the fact that the legislature and a court are oftentimes at odds with each other. We see it at the federal level. We see this in other states. We have it happens where there are the federal model of judicial selection. You have it where there's justices that are actively voted on in partisan and nonpartisan elections. So
you're not advocating for that, though.
No. I actually I'm very much against.
Because the governor has mentioned that he wants anything but this, including up to and including electing judges.
Yeah,
you're not for that.
I am not for that, and I think that a couple of years ago, with what happened with Wisconsin specifically, Scott Walker was having a lot of internal conflict and how they wanted to operate the state. In the course of that, there's a court case that was going up Supreme Court, and you had a partisan election coming up, and you had people trying to replace one Supreme Court justice so that they could get an opinion in their favor. And I think selling Supreme Court opinions at the ballot box. Maybe it works well for other states. It's not an approach that I want to do here.
Brian, the amendment went down in the House, needed 2/3 of a vote. It got a majority, but it didn't get the 2/3. Mm-hmm. Is it dead? Is it going to come back? Because my impression now is that nothing dies over there.
Yeah, this is always the joke is that nothing dies in the Capitol, so make sure you're buried there when you go. The issue is definitely not dead. Whether or not there's another attempt to have a vote on it this year, I think the representative would actually have a better sense of that. It was kind of interesting talking to the House Speaker after it went down. We kind of pressed him on it, and he said, "Well, he actually expected it to go down." He said it got one vote less than what he predicted. So there seemed to be an awareness going in that the proposed constitutional amendment wasn't going to get the 2/3 majority, but that's led some moderates, people who do call themselves moderates, and some people who don't want to be called moderates, but most people mm-hmm. would call to feel that it was a postcard vote. Yeah. I'm not saying that's true, but there's been some people who think that this is going to be used in the election, and whether or not the vote was a postcard vote, I think the issue will come up in the election because you have 5 of the 7 justices are up for retention,
right.
And you saw that judicial selection did become, at the end of the governor's race last year, it did become a major issue. So I think it's something that is definitely going to be talked about in House and Senate races. It's definitely going to be an issue on the ballot even if the proposed amendment isn't there because – we'll be voting on the legislature with an awareness that this is an issue, and you'll be voting on whether or not to retain court justices with the awareness that this is an issue. If you could actually, the speaker was kind of offended by the suggestion that some people were making that it was a postcard vote, that it was intended to be used the election time. If you could just kind of weigh in as the bill's sponsor about that.
I don't view it as a postcard vote. I don't know that I really know what a postcard vote would be. It's a bill that a lot of people care about. Like you said, in the last governor's race, it was a big issue, specifically with the Carr Brothers ruling, which is much more important to our Wichita delegation in that part of the state. There's a lot of people who want to have the opportunity to vote on this, and I think that's an important thing I didn't mention earlier, that this isn't – we can't change this. It has to be a constitutional amendment. It has to be a vote of the people that would make a change on this. And there's a lot of people across the state who would like to have that opportunity. If we only brought up bills that we knew we had the votes on, I think that's a bad way to run a democratic chamber, and we certainly have bills that do come up and fail that are – and this isn't the only one. Yeah. So,
if you guys did go by that system, the tax debate last year would have been even slower.
Yeah. Exactly.
And I do think retention elections – I mean, somebody after the Gannon ruling was issued, I can't remember who it was, but a legislator specifically said almost sort of as a threat, like retention elections.
Jeff Melcher, Jeff Melcher did
retention's
say
definitely going to be a big deal.
Absolutely.
An issue that comes up in those retention issues. I think every reporter ended up using Melcher's quotes. That was great. Melcher had one of the fieriest responses. It was funny because I had actually – I'll tell you. I interviewed Jeff about his opinion about the decision shortly after it came out, because I just kind of went up. So what lawmakers were around, talked to him, and he, you know, gave me some good quotes. And then I went on to talk to more lawmakers. And then he came back and found me and said, oh, you know, I just thought about something else. And I just wanted to add this. And he called it a temper tantrum the Supreme Court. And then, you know, I think I said to like somebody else down the press, I was like, you guys got to talk to Melcher. And I think Melcher ended up in every single person's story that day.
I'm going to move on to guns in just a second, but I just want to follow up with one question here on judges. And you know, you're a proponent for moving to the federal model, and that would be in our case, the governor would nominate, the Senate would confirm. Don't you think though that the difference between the Kansas Senate and the United States Senate is that the Judiciary Committee and the United States Senate has any number of people looking for them, working for them, who will vet the candidate, who read everything that they write before we have a hearing. There's certainly not that ability to vet judges in the Kansas Senate that way. Wouldn't you agree?
I wouldn't agree, because I think that you're speaking only to the elected officials. I don't think that just because the bar or a nominating commission isn't officially part of the process doesn't mean that they wouldn't have input at the federal level. The American Bar Association does ratings of judges. It makes recommendations to senators on what they think, who would be a bad judge or a good judge, what these judges have done in the past. I think the bar could serve a similar role here to say that.
But there's also a huge staff on the Judiciary Committee. There's a background investigation by the FBI. I mean, there's an intense vetting process at the federal level that you think could be replicated here in Kansas.
I think you could move towards something like that. You could even – I mean, there's a lot of ways you could approach this. I mean, you could have the judiciary set up subcommittees. We have judicial councils. We have different things that could be put in place that could allow for a more intense vetting process than maybe what people are thinking that is.
So. If you sat through the Court of Appeals confirmation hearings last year for Catherine Gardner, I'll tell you, Jeff King, I'm not speaking for every lawmaker, but Jeff King is pretty darn thorough. I mean, Jeff King really grilled her. He really did some very thorough research, I think, on every aspect of her background. That said, even though the judiciary chairman was dead opposed to her confirmation, she did end up getting confirmed by the Senate and is now on the Court of Appeals. But I think that certainly watching those hearings, it's not necessarily going to be a cakewalk if the Senate Judiciary
Chamber. Well, and we don't see that at the federal level either. Anybody who can remember, it's a little bit before my time, I was alive, but not really active. There was the Bork hearings of the 80s and, the Harriet Meyer under the Bush administration. I think that the idea that a Senate, whether it be in the Kansas or at the federal level, is just a rubber stamp is unfounded. I think that they will do their due diligence.
And just one more follow-up. The merit selection process, which has been around in Kansas since 1958, born out of what I think you could legitimately say is the only scandal to come out of the Kansas judiciary. You think it has not served Kansas well, or has it run out of its useful time?
I would say that it has served Kansas well, and I think the bar should probably be thanked to a certain degree for making sure that we do have quality courts. For me, it's not about whether this is a good or bad. It's about what's the more democratic way to elect judges. We are supposed to be a democratic society. This is part of the great American experiment, self-rule, and allowing the people or elected and citizens, the representative of the elected citizens, the Senate, to have more say in who becomes our judges is a worthy goal. And right now not only is the selection committee selective in who they nominate, it's selective in who gets to vote on who is on that merit committee. So,
and you don't think retention fulfills the democratic need?
Well, we've never had a judge fail on retention. I don't think so because to me, it's the democratic need is not just – it's about the legitimacy of the court. And I feel like right now the question is – less about the quality, it's about how much faith do they people have in the court. And I think having a more democratic input in it is going to hopefully increase the respect and prestige of the court and the views of the people. Because like I said, this is an issue that a lot of people have problems with for whatever variety of reasons that they might have.
Lisa, your face is scrunched up. And before we move on, I'm going to give you the final word on this particular
issue. I'm very supportive of the merits election process. I wrote to oppose the bill last week, and I was pleased to see that it didn't get voted through. I think that retention elections do allow educated voters who are actively engaged in it to have their democratic say in the process.
All right. Now, I don't know what's going to happen. There's been a lot of talk on guns. We've talked about moving back the deadline to allow guns on college campuses. We've talked about moving up the deadline for allowing guns on college campuses. So the question I'm going to throw out here to anybody who wants to jump on it first is anything going to happen with guns in this legislative session?
Well, there's definitely going to be a few things that happen with guns this session. The Senate had the debate where amendments were brought to – it had a debate on a gun bill, which I'll get to the underlying bill in a second. But the college campus issue came up twice. First, there was an attempt to push back the deadline in which –
to 2021?
Yeah, basically, for those who aren't familiar, public universities in 2017, July of 2017, will have to open up their campuses to concealed carry. Right now, there's an exemption for them. So there was an attempt to move that back to 2021, and then there was an attempt to move it up to 2016. Both of those amendments fail. So right now in the Senate, it looks like that deadline is going to stay where it is, which is 2017. The universities are working on getting ready for that, but there's still a lot of pushback from faculty and students. And that was actually Ralph Ostemeyer. He chastised Michael O'Donnell for bringing the amendment to move it up and said, look, the colleges are already uncomfortable with this. We have to work with them in order to get them ready. We just voted down the thing to push it up. Why are you going to, you know, try to pile on them now by moving it up? So I don't think that will change. Now, the underlying bill, I don't know if you followed this one, Sam. I think this is going to be a controversial bill. It passed the Senate. I'm interested to see what happens with it in the House. The underlying bill, right now, public employees are allowed to carry concealed in public buildings. So, you know, state worker can come into the docking building or the Capitol. And, you know, if it's legal for them to carry, they can, you know, carry concealed and there's no problem. But in many cases, they are prohibited from from bringing those concealed firearms with them when they go off site, but are still on duty. This bill would allow public employees, whenever they're on the job, to carry concealed. And so you had some lawmakers who said that, you know, this means that a city code inspector, who's not necessarily a trained law enforcement officer, can come to your house carrying a concealed weapon. And Tom Holland threw out the question of, you know, what if there's a dog? You know, what if there's a pit bull and get scared? A little bit later in that debate, Aletha Faust-Godeau was pressing Forrest Knox, who is the bill's sponsor, you know, on a similar point about, well, will the public agency have to inform a person if there's going to be someone coming, you know, over their house, you know, with a gun? And Forrest Knox did say this. I'm not making this up. I have it in print. I believe me, people, this was said on the floor of the Kansas Senate Thursday night. He said that if he was a meter man checking the senator from Sedgwick's meter and her pit bull attacked him, he may have to shoot it. So you did have a member of the Kansas Senate tell another member of the Kansas Senate that if necessary, he would shoot her dog to protect himself. Now, Senator Foscadeau clarified that she does not have a pit bull. She does have a cat. Her name is Miss Kitty.
I want to bring James in on this, and I'm going to assume that you are not pro shooting pit bulls, so we will go past that and ask how that bill is going to do in the House.
Or cats. I have no animus towards Miss Kitty. This may sound weird. I'm not really that familiar with the bill. Mm-hmm. I've seen it. I am the vice chair of Fed and State Affairs, and my understanding would be as if a bill like that's going to come to my committee to be dealt with. I really don't have any strong opinions. I've been, again, kind of dealing with some of the bills that we have. We had a gun bill that came out of Fed and State Affairs. We haven't passed on the floor yet, which is meant to, as this waiver goes out, to give local authorities a little bit more leeway in how they decide to organize their buildings. You get in some small counties in which you have a multipurpose building, maybe a courtroom's on the second floor. The way that the law is read right now, the entire building has to either allow for concealed carry or it has to prohibit everywhere. The bill that we passed out of the federal and state affairs that hasn't gone to the floor of the House would allow for them to, say, have the second floor where the courtroom is restricted and not allow concealed carry and allow it on the bottom floor. So it's actually a bill that gives a little bit more leeway into local municipalities. It doesn't really jump into, although it would apply, I would assume, to the universities as well as their public buildings. But I don't really have any strong opinion. I just really haven't contemplated the law yet.
And the issue there is there's kind of gun rights versus private property rights.
Right.
Now, what Senator Knox said is that a property owner, just like you see many businesses in Kansas have no gun signs up, said that a homeowner could put up a sign that says that. So I don't know if this bill does become law, if you're going to see all throughout Kansas
is that regulated?
No,
I mean, do you when someone comes to my door, do I ask them to show me if they're
well? I think up on the state website, you put a PDF with one of those guns with a slash through it, and you download that, and you just tape that up on your door. I want to take one more trip around the table before we end here. And so, Lisa, your final thought or your final question for James Todd?
Well, my question is, as a constituent, to speaking to a legislator, I'm curious to hear sort of what you see as impact of constituents writing emails, making phone calls, that sort of thing. I think I have some friends who say, oh, I know my legislator is going to vote opposite, how I believe, so I'm not going to bother emailing him because it's not going to make a difference. I have some people who say, well, I'm sure my legislator is going to vote the way I want him or her to, so I won't bother clogging up her email box. But I think in a time of really difficult decisions that are being made in the legislature all the time, how do you help people connect the dots between what happens in their schools, in their daily lives, and what's happening in Topeka, and what would you say to constituents to make their voices heard while all these big decisions are being made?
And by the way, I think we should point out that a bill in the Education Committee, the House Education Committee, went down pretty hard because of a clogged email box, among other things. So I'm interested.
To clarify, you're wanting my impression of what weight I put on emails or what the best way for constituents to contact their elected officials?
Well, I think maybe a broader question of, with big decisions facing the legislature that are going to impact families all over Kansas, how do you suggest that I call it connecting the dots? How do you suggest that constituents find a way to pay attention to what's going on in Topeka and then have their voices heard while those decisions are being made?
Well, as far as paying attention, that can be that's what the media and everybody's there for. That's what people like Brian are hopefully servicing the community and providing them with accurate information. As far as connecting with legislators, Having been up here for 4 years, I would say my answer is complicated, and only insofar as I've had I get emails just like everybody else, and I try to do my best and respond to emails, letters to individuals. I have had other conversations where I've had with constituents expressing to them, well, you know, hey, make sure you get a hold of that person, and they kind of say the exact opposite response, and that, well, we voted for you. And you're up there to represent us. We don't want to micromanage you, in essence. So to me, I would leave it to the discretion of what the constituent feels like they want the role of their legislator to be. It could be I actually had an interesting conversation with an intern about this, because it's kind of a philosophical divide on, do you want more active input from your legislator? Do you want them to be a surrogate in which they go up there and then you tell them what to do and then they vote accordingly? Or do you want a model in which you are voting for an individual and then you're relying more upon their reasoning and rationale, and then you'll hold them accountable when it comes time for voting? So I don't really want to tell my constituents how they want to do that. If a constituent wants to email me, if they want to send me a letter, I will appreciate that, and I will read it, and I will give it its due weight. But that's not the only avenue, I guess, to communicate, and not all constituents, and having known that and having had conversations with different constituents, not all of them want to be as actively involved in that way.
Brian Lowry, your final thought or your final question for James?
I guess, since you're a Kansas City area lawmaker, I'll have to ask you about, the other night in the Kansas Senate, there was this amendment added on actually by Jim Denning, your predecessor, which is going to restrict STAR bonds. STAR bonds are these sales tax revenue bonds. They were used to build the
most
legends,
famously, right? Which, all of the legends, you know, is STAR bond generated.
Apparently, there is this idea being weighed, at least according to Senator Denning, that the governor wants to use STAR bonds as a way to lure the American Royal over from Missouri into Kansas. His point is, you know, STAR bonds take sales tax revenue to pay off these bonds on these building projects. And, you know, he just says we don't have the money for that right now. When you look at the budget.
Just to clarify, it uses the sales tax generated by the project.
Correct.
Not just any sales tax.
Right. Thank you for clarifying that. But It basically, the point being that this is sales tax that would otherwise go into
general
state
fund
coffers, right? And so Denning's point is we don't really have the money to start diverting sales tax when we've moved to a model where we're particularly reliant on sales tax to pay for most of our finances, since we've zeroed out income tax for so many business owners. And so I guess my question for you is where you stand on that, because I also know, especially from some House members, that there's a lot of pushback from this from local chambers of commerce, from city governments who think the STAR bonds program is necessary for economic development. So that's going to be a fight with the budget, I think, as things go forward. And I'd be interested, as a House member who wasn't part of that Senate debate, where you stand on it.
Well, I guess first, Jim's very knowledgeable. I read your story.
Yeah.
I think it was last night on it, and I thought it was very good. There's a lot of questions, I think, on both sides of the state line. I know that there was some stuff in Kansas City, Missouri involving TIF districts on how to properly utilize these development-type programs, obviously the STAR bond one. I don't know the specifics of what the governor's intent was. I think I mirror Senator Denning's questions, in which they're seeking to undermine sales tax, which is, again, the governor's desired way to approach revenue in the state, even though a number of us would like to see a change in the way that we are doing as far as the pass-through income is concerned. I have a bill that's probably not as grandiose as that in the House that has to deal with TIF districts that I've introduced in tax. Because we're seeing a similar thing when it comes to municipal governments giving out a TIF district and it undermining the capital outlay portion of what school districts are applying. And what we're seeing in Kansas and Johnson County often is a mixed-use type TIF district in which you have retail, maybe offices, and a residential. And so you have people moving into an area, presumably bringing kids with them, increasing the need. But again, not contributing to the capital outlay portion. So I guess as succinctly as say, I think that there's a good reason to have some criticism of how these things are done, especially when the state is in a difficult situation as far as finances. And I mean, we're talking, if I remember correctly, $42 million.
Yeah. That's about that's the number that Denning says and should be going into the general fund.
Well, and I tried to pull up the numbers last night. Again, we'll find out, I'm sure, as it moves along, because I tried to pull up some stuff in the Department of Commerce and what has been part of that project in the past. And he obviously was looking at some budgetary numbers and what's on the expectations. So I think that having scrutiny right now is probably the right time to do it.
That's emerging as a major theme of the legislative session. More transparency, more legislative oversight, whether that comes to the state hospitals, whether that comes to
the power plant,
economic development programs,
bonding programs, the power plant.
So that's it's becoming, as a reporter, I'm very pleasantly surprised that this has become the theme of the session. And I will say this. Yesterday, I asked the Department of Commerce to just give me a list of all of your active STAR bonds projects throughout the state, because they're used all throughout the state, and they refuse. So these are, you know, publicly funded projects, and the Department of Commerce refused to disclose the list to me, saying it would violate privacy laws in these deals that they have with some businesses. The city of Wichita disclosed to me all of their STAR bonds projects. I don't think there actually is a prohibition, but it was interesting that the agency wouldn't just, you know, give me a list of these are the projects, this is where they are, and this is how much they cost.
Representative Todd, can you help my colleague Brian Lowry get this list?
I will be requesting it. I'll do what I can. Yes.
All right.
I will be requesting
something. You are a good man. I am going to call a halt to this podcast because we went STAR, TIF, LOB. We took a real turn. We took a real turn for the wonk right there. So I am calling a halt to this. Brian Lowry, my colleague from the Wichita Eagle, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Lisa Vaglin from Prairie Village, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And this is where we turn the podcast over to you, James. To get to know you a little bit better, we let you pick the walk-off music. What is the song that is going through your head right now?
I actually was kind of aware of this, and I thought of a song that I really like, one of my favorite bands from the 60s, a band called The Kinks. And I love the song, The 20th Century Man.
I didn't know that you don't look like a man from the 60s, but anything from The Kinks is well worth it. Statehouse Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. You can subscribe to us on iTunes. Find us on kcur.org/statehouseblend. And our friends over there at Up to Date with Steve Kraske. You guys listen to the Kraske?
Good guy.
Clears out a little room for us every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Want to sit right there where Lisa is? I'll bet you do. Go ahead. If you want to be on a future State House Blend, you can email me. I'm at sam@kcur.org. If you follow just one State House reporter on the Twitter, it should be Brian Lowry. What's your Twitter handle?
It is Brian, and sorry, I spell it B-R-Y-A-N, Lowry, L-O-W-R-Y, and three, because there are a couple guys ahead of me. So at Brian Lowry 3.
And you can follow me on the Twitter. I'm at Sam Zeff. My co-host, Brian Ellison, is at PTS Brian. I'm Sam Zeff. Thanks for finding us. I'll see you around the radio.